hit. BOA One, the hit. Take a look and
welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Novak tells us why some scientists say Earth is now in a danger zone. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Earth is now considered to be in a danger zone, a new study says. An international group of scientists called Earth Commission did the study. It appeared in the publication Nature. The researchers report that conditions on Earth have pushed past 7 of 8 safety limits established by science. The experts say the planet is very sick and all life, humans included, face extreme risks as a result. The study examines climate, air pollution, fertilizer pollution in water, groundwater supplies, fresh surface water, the unbuilt natural environment, and the larger human-built environment. The research shows each of those areas have passed into dangerous conditions worldwide. Only air pollution is within the identified safety zone, the scientists report. However, the report notes that air pollution is dangerous at local levels. The study found problem hotspot areas throughout the world, much of it from climate change. About 2/3 of Earth does not meet safe levels for freshwater supply, scientists said. Joyita Gupta is the Earth Commission co-chair and professor of environment at the University of Amsterdam. She told reporters that if planet Earth went to a medical exam, our doctor would say that the Earth is really quite sick right now, and it is also affecting the people living on Earth. But the planet can recover if people make changes, the researchers report. Such reforms would include reducing the use of coal, oil, and natural gas, and improving treatment of land and water, the scientists said. But we are moving in the wrong direction on basically all of these, said study lead author Johan Rockström from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. The team of about 40 scientists created measurable boundaries for each environmental category. They decided the level where it is safe for the planet. The point at which it becomes harmful for groups of people, the researchers called a justice issue. Rockström said he thinks of those points as setting up a safety fence, outside of which the risks become higher, but not necessarily disastrous. Rockström and other scientists have attempted in the past this type of measuring of Earth's connected ecosystems. The big difference in this attempt is that scientists also looked at local and area levels and added the idea of justice. The justice part includes fairness between young and old generations, different nations, and even different species. Frequently, it applies to conditions that harm people more than the planet. An example of that is climate change. The report uses the same boundary of 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming that international leaders agreed upon in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. The world has, so far, warmed about 1.1 degrees Celsius, so it has not crossed that safety fence, Rockstrom and Gupta said. But that does not mean people are not being hurt. What we are trying to show through our paper is that even at 1 degree centigrade, there is a huge amount of damage taking place, Gupta said. The planetary safety boundary of 1.5 degrees has not been reached, but the just boundary of 1 degree where people are hurt has been. Stanford Environmental Studies head Chris Field was not part of the research. He said he would want even more strict boundaries. Sustainability and justice are inseparable, he said. I'm Dan Novak.
Some companies have created artificial intelligence, AI tools, to block abusive comments directed at professional soccer players. The tools are aimed at limiting abusive messages about race and other issues targeting soccer players on social media. A British organization that campaigns against discrimination in soccer, called Kick It Out, said racism is the most common form of abuse reported on social media. The group's finding is based on data collected over the past 3 seasons in English soccer. Soccer's governing body, FIFA, released a report on the problem last year. The report said more than half of players taking part in 2 major competitions in 2021 received some form of abuse on social media. The competitions were the African Cup of Nations and the European Championship. FIFA found that more than 1/3 of 400,000 social media posts about soccer players were described as racial abuse. Black French soccer star Kylian Mbappé has 104 million followers on Instagram and more than 12 million followers on Twitter. He was the subject of racial abuse along with black teammate Kingsley Coman after their French national team lost in the 2022 World Cup final to Argentina. Real Madrid player Vinicius Jr., who is also black, has been the target of racial insults. But he is still active on social media with 38 million followers on Instagram and nearly 7 million on Twitter. Another black player who has been targeted online is Bukayo Saka, who plays for Premier League team Arsenal as well as Britain's national team. Saka has more than 1 million followers on Twitter. He remains on social media even after receiving abuse over England's loss in the Euro 2020 competition. A few weeks ago, a message targeting Saka was posted on Twitter. The message showed Saka with his face made to look like a monkey, along with the words, "This clown has cost us the league." Minutes before the message was posted, Saka had missed a penalty in an important Premier League game. Players and teams say they want to remove insults and racial abuse from social media. British technology company GoBubble aims to block comments considered discriminatory. The company's founder, Henry Platten, told the Associated Press the current problems were made possible by technology. But he added, tech can actually solve the issue, and this is what we are seeing as one of those pieces of the jigsaw. GoBubble's AI technology tool is linked to players' social media accounts. The tool searches for harmful words, images, and abusive messages, which it can block. Official bodies are reacting to the problem as well. During last year's World Cup in Qatar, FIFA and players' organization, FIFPro, used a special moderation service to block racist and abusive posts from being seen online by players and their followers. The same service will be offered for the upcoming Women's World Cup. In 2021, soccer officials in England led a four-day social media boycott against Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The move aimed to protest the company's moderation and enforcement efforts against online abuse. Activists accuse Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, and Twitter of being too slow to block racist comments, remove violators' accounts, and change verification methods. Verification can make it more difficult for banned users to sign up for new accounts. Mark Bright is a former black player in Britain's Premier League who remembers suffering racial abuse at stadiums during the 1980s. He told the AP he thinks social media companies need to be regulated by the government. He believes the companies should be punished for any harm caused by their services. Everyone's been complaining about this for a long time now, Bright said. He added, some players have set up meetings with these social media companies. It seems to me that they're not serious enough about it. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about this week's technology report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure, Ashley. Glad to be here.
Your report dealt with some online tools designed to limit online abuse directed at professional soccer players. It is noted that racist abuse is especially a problem in Britain. How have leaders in the sport reacted to the issues raised?
Yes, this continues to be a problem in Britain and in other places in Europe, but the report notes that even soccer's international governing body, FIFA, has gotten involved with teams and companies to find new ways to block abusive and racist content on social media.
And how have tech companies reacted to the criticism from players, teams, and international soccer officials?
Yes, the Associated Press reached out to Meta, owner of Facebook and Instagram, for comment, and the company again defended its current moderation methods and said any racist or abusive material is removed from its services as soon as possible after being identified. And there was no response from Twitter.
Some experts in the soccer industry have repeatedly called for government regulation as a way to hold technology companies more accountable for any harms their services cause. Have any of these efforts progressed recently?
So nothing has been finalized yet, But last month, the European Union did reach agreement to move forward its Digital Services Act legislation. The act aims to force tech companies to better protect European users from different kinds of harmful online content, and it would punish companies with big fines if they violate the law.
Okay. Well, thanks again for joining me today, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We tell the story of the 38th President of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, my dear friends, my fellow Americans, the oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans.
Gerald Ford was sworn into office on August 9, 1974. Ford was vice president to Richard Nixon, who had announced the day before that he would resign. If Nixon had not resigned, he might have been removed from office. Congress had been moving to charge him with corruption in the Watergate case. At his swearing-in ceremony, the new president spoke about the nation's future.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule.
He went on to say,
as we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate.
Gerald Ford became the only leader in American history to have served both as vice president and president without being elected. Richard Nixon chose him as vice president in October 1973. That was when Nixon's former vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned because of criminal charges that he failed to pay his taxes. When Nixon himself resigned, Ford became president. Ford was a longtime congressman from the state of Michigan. He was well liked by his congressional colleagues. His education was in economics and political science at the University of Michigan. Then he attended Yale Law School. During World War II, he served as a naval officer in the Pacific. After the war, Ford entered politics. He was a member of the Republican Party. He was first elected to the House of Representatives in 1948. He won re-election 12 times. Republicans in the House elected him the minority leader during the administration of Democratic President Lyndon Johnson. Ford was still minority leader when Richard Nixon, a fellow Republican, was elected president in 1968. In his leadership position, Ford helped win approval of a number of Nixon's proposals. He became known for his strong loyalty to the president. It was no surprise then when Nixon named Ford as vice president. Gerald Ford was an accidental president. He came to office in a sudden turn of events. Almost as suddenly, he had to decide what to do about the former president. After Nixon left office, he could have been charged with crimes for his part in covering up the events of Watergate. Instead, 1 month after Nixon resigned, President Ford settled the question. He pardoned Nixon for any crimes that he might have committed. The pardoning of Nixon made many Americans angry. Some believed he should have been put on trial. They thought he might have answered more questions about Watergate if he had not been pardoned. Ford said he pardoned Nixon in an effort to unite the country. For a while, though, the pardon only seemed to intensify the divisions.
And I wondered whether anybody had brought to your attention the fact that the Constitution specifically states that even though somebody is impeached, that person shall nonetheless be liable to punishment according to law.
In October 1974, President Ford appeared before a congressional hearing on the pardon. He gave a strong response to questioning by Democratic Representative Elizabeth Holtzman.
Mrs. Holtzman, I was fully cognizant of the fact that the president, on resignation, was accountable for any criminal charges. But I would like to say that the reason I gave the pardon was not as to Mr. Nixon himself. I repeat, and I repeat with emphasis, the purpose of the pardon was to try and get the United States, the Congress, the President, and the American people focusing on the serious problems we have both at home and abroad. And I was absolutely convinced then, as I am now, that if we had had this series, an indictment, a trial, a conviction, and anything else that transpired after that, that the attention of the President, the Congress, and the American people would have been diverted from the problems that we have to solve. And that was the principal reason for my granting of the pardon.
Anger about the pardon was still strong when President Ford made another controversial decision. He pardoned men who had illegally avoided military service in the Vietnam War. Most of them were not sent to prison. Instead, they were offered a chance to do work for their communities. Many of the men, however, did not accept the president's offer. Some stayed in Canada or other countries where they had fled to avoid the draft. President Ford received greater public support when he asked Congress to limit the activities of the nation's intelligence agencies. He hoped better control would prevent future administrations from abusing the constitutional rights of Americans as Nixon had done. On another issue, Ford, while serving as vice president, had described inflation as America's public enemy number one. He had supported several measures to fight it. As president, however, an economic recession forced him to cancel some of those measures. Inflation decreased during the recession, but unemployment increased. On foreign policy issues, Ford kept Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State. Kissinger had won much praise for his service to Richard Nixon, including in the opening of diplomatic ties with Communist China. But Kissinger had also received much criticism. Critics accused him of interfering with civil liberties in the name of national security. They also accused him of supporting the overthrow of the Marxist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. By the time Ford became president, the United States and the Soviet Union had taken steps to try to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. Nixon and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev had signed two such agreements as part of the détente policy to ease Cold War tensions. Relations with China were also less tense than before. American policy in Southeast Asia, however, had failed. Involvement in the Vietnam War had officially ended the year before Gerald Ford became president. But fighting continued between South Vietnam and communist forces from the North. The peace agreement, signed by the United States and North Vietnam in 1973, left South Vietnam to defend itself. By 1975, South Vietnamese forces were clearly in danger of defeat. President Ford tried to prevent a communist takeover. He asked Congress to approve $700 million in military aid for South Vietnam. Congress said no. The American people were tired of paying for the war. Saigon, the South Vietnamese capital, fell to communist forces on April 30, 1975. President Ford ordered the rescue of American citizens and South Vietnamese who had supported the American efforts. Few people who saw those struggling to escape Saigon will ever forget that day. Terrified Vietnamese were screaming for help at the American embassy. Everyone was pushing, trying to escape the city. Some held on to overloaded military helicopters as the aircraft tried to take off. As a signal to American citizens to prepare to leave, Armed Forces Radio had played the song White Christmas. Some were to go to an apartment building where a helicopter would pick them up from the roof. But other people also tried to get onto the helicopter, a scene captured in a famous news photo of the fall of Saigon. The former South Vietnamese capital was renamed Ho Chi Minh City. In the Middle East, Henry Kissinger led negotiations after the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. Israel agreed to give up some captured territory. In return, the United States promised not to recognize or deal with the Palestine Liberation Organization unless the PLO met certain conditions. In September 1975, Israel and Egypt signed an agreement that included permission for American civilians to act as observers along the ceasefire lines. Henry Kissinger was praised for his peacemaking efforts, though peace in the Middle East would remain a challenge for future administrations. At home, things seemed better as the presidential election campaign of 1976 began. That year marked the nation's 200th birthday. The United States was not fighting any wars. Unemployment remained high, but inflation had eased. Most importantly, Gerald Ford had led the country through the difficult period after Watergate.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.